Welcome to B2B Better, a podcast that exists to explore what modern-day B2B marketing looks like. If you work for a company with long sales cycles, has a complex value proposition, and simply pouring money into ads won't see you hit your growth goals, this is the show for you. My name's Jason Bradwell. Let's get into it. Hey, everyone. Today, I'm excited to be joined by Yuen Tsang, CEO of Disruptive Thinking. I was really interested in speaking with Yuen to unpack his journey in finding differentiation in an incredibly saturated sector, B2B marketing services, something that's very close to my heart. During this interview, he took me through his journey from blank slate to thriving agency, sharing his blueprint around three core pillars of growth: building the right team, implementing discipline around business development, and getting to grips with the customer journey, all while building the right systems and processes to track and analyze these efforts. So if you work in a small, service-led business and are hitting a wall when it comes to growth, this is the episode for you. Finally, before we get started, I'd like to thank SoPro again for sponsoring this episode. They've just published this awesome report, The State of Prospecting 2024, which offers data-backed, practical advice on how to optimize outreach in order to stay ahead of the competition. So I'm going to drop the link to the report in the show notes of this episode. Make sure you check it out. So today on B2B Better, I'm very excited to be joined by Yuen Tsang, who is the Chief Executive Officer of Disruptive Thinking. How are you doing, Yuen?
I'm really good. Thank you for having me.
Real pleasure to have you here. So tell me a little bit about who you are and what you're doing over there at Disruptive Thinking.
So I'm the CEO, which sounds quite fancy for a company of five people, but it seems to be the fashionable thing to do. So I founded the company back in 2017. Before that, I was a publisher at a media company in Bristol, always working in the B2B space, selling advertising campaigns, media content to companies like Xero, Microsoft, Eon. So a really broad range of B2B clients. I left that business in 2017, set up Disruptive, and originally set it up to be a consultant to other publishers and media owners to say, look, don't make the mistakes that I made. Nobody was interested. But a lot of my previous clients were really interested to bring us in and to bring me on, even to help them with their marketing, with their outreach, with their strategy, and with their execution. So that's where we started. And that's what we do. So we essentially help our clients with the marketing, the strategy side of things, the execution of that kind of marketing strategy. And in recent times, we found ourselves having more and more conversations around CRM systems. So with all the activity that we organize and we manage for our clients, how do they actually track it? How do they measure the success of it? It was really important to us to show that we were delivering value. So as I say, the conversation invariably ended up around CRM systems. And then very recently, we've become HubSpot partners. So we're going all in on the HubSpot side of things and getting better at using that particular system to help our clients with their marketing.
Excellent, excellent. And you said that you're five people. Tell me a little bit about the kind of journey of bringing people into the business, moving from your kind of solo consultancy into an agency. It's a similar journey to the one I've taken. I finished up at my previous organization, started consulting. It was great, easy, dare I say. And then you start bringing people in as you try and scale, and that introduces a whole host of new challenges. So tell me a little bit about that journey for you.
I think you summed it up, really. It's easy is probably quite an interesting word to say. And somebody once said to me, you're never more profitable than when you're just working for yourself. And that's really true. But it's been a really fulfilling journey for me. So when I was in my previous role and when I was working for a company, one of my favorite parts of the work was managing a team and really getting the best out of the team. And whilst going solo, I actually had a co-founder at the time, whilst we were just doing the work, it was fine, but it was really difficult, as you say, to scale. And one of the biggest lessons I learned was when we were doing some work with Deloitte and the partner that we were working with there, he would always ask me, are you leveraging your time, Yuen? What are you doing to leverage? What are you doing to leverage? And he was quite an intimidating bloke. And one day I said to him, what do you mean when you say leverage, Mark? And he said, when you're doing delivery work, you do one day, you get paid for one day. It's one for one. What you need to do is think about what you can do that where the effort and the time that you put in gets you back more than one-to-one. So that might be training people, that might be recruiting, business development, and all these things. And that really stuck with me. So in order to leverage, we needed to grow the team. We needed to bring people in who could do the stuff that we were doing so that we could then go out and win more business or develop the strategy or whatever it might be. The first couple of hires that we did were tricky because we basically went cheap. We tried to go young, fresh, bright and breezy. We brought them in and they were great. The challenge that we had was that perhaps it was a generational thing. It was quite a transient type of workforce. So they moved from job to job quite quickly. And we found out very quickly that the investment that you put into this kind of generation, it was natural for them to move on quite quickly. Our transformative hire was our operations director, Jenny Hall, and she brought basically a wise head. And it was really interesting because she brought to the company the kind of structure and the organization that it's not the sort of thing that you normally bill for. So it's not the sort of thing that kind of generates money, but it's enabled us to grow the skill that we have. And then we built the team out. And do you know what? I think the most enjoyable aspect has been building the team, engaging with the new team members. And when one of our clients actually asked me, how would you describe the culture of Disruptive? And it came very naturally at the time, because I just thought, what we try and do is we try and bring the best out of each other. And that's what I think our culture is that it isn't about just making yourself look good, but it's about creating an environment and being supportive for everybody else so that they can be their best. And then that obviously goes around full circle. So, it's been tough. We made some mistakes. We've had to make some tough decisions in recent years as well. But if you can back that up with data, it helps you sleep at night when you have to make those tough decisions. And if you can keep, you know, your team engaged, motivated, then they run through walls for you and they do it willingly. And you can't help but reciprocate and help them do that.
The strength of a team with the kind of business that you're building and the industry that you're operating in is so important when selling services. And often it can be looked at as one of your core differentiators, the power of the people behind the logo. And so tell me a little bit about how you're thinking about differentiation as a creative services agency that's operating in a competitive market.
That's such a good question, Jason. There's a few things. I think I'd like to say that it was more through design, but I think it was, to be fair, more through coincidence, really. We've been very lucky in terms of our hiring process of people that we bring on. We do things like having a chemistry test, but from a capability perspective, we then have almost like a personality perspective as well. And it's always been one of the questions I ask in previous roles as well. Some advice from my old MD, actually, when I was working with that publishing company, was how comfortable would you feel putting them in front of a client? In front of your best client. So from that perspective, it's been very kind of people driven. And as you say, that's one of the key kind of differentiators. And what has been very interesting, especially in more recent times, has been some of the new clients that we brought on board. The reason why we won the work was because in our proposals, in our engagement with the discovery sessions that we ran with these kind of prospects as well, what came very natural to us around lots of engagement, lots of consultation, lots of discussions and feedback loops and lots of this kind of interaction with the client. We've had around about 60%, let's say, of the deals that we won actually came back. That was one of the key reasons why they went with us, because the other competitive pitches where there was one, they were very systemized. It's quite interesting. We talked a little bit about systems before I jumped on this interview, but you can see it already where there are some models that are out there where the only interaction that you have is through a Trello board or through some other project management scheme, and you talk on a card and that is it, which has its efficiencies. And there are definitely organizations who prefer to work that way. But I think for us, at the light bulb moment was like, look, people still want that human connection. People still want to have that type of interaction. And some people still want, some people definitely want the hands-off thing. But for us, we understood that we love working with clients in that way. So the clients that do want that level of interaction. So we work really collaboratively. It's one of our kind of values, is to collaborate, with the small Vanilla Rice reference in there as well. So for us, it's important that we work with clients who want to collaborate. So putting that out as a point of differentiation helps not only win the clients that you want to work with, but perhaps also helps just keep at arm's length the clients that you don't. It's probably the key kind of takeaway, I'd say, from that. So to your question, it is a saturated market. It is really competitive as well. But for us, it's really important for us to understand what kind of clients do we want to work with. And then I suppose articulating what our differentiation is in the context of those clients.
Yeah. It's almost introducing some kind of self-selection mechanisms within your clients. And this is how we operate. And we're putting that out there into the world. And we're in a position where we can say, if that's not the way that you want to operate, no problem, but probably not going to be a good fit for us. And so that then frees you up talking about leveraging time to focus on the clients that you already have who want to work in that way and delivering a better service and improving that stickiness and it creating those upsell, cross-sell opportunities, but also then focus on winning those new clients that do fit that criteria.
I think you hit the nail on the head there. I think our biggest client, we've been working with them for 3-4 years. When was the start of lockdown? Since the start of lockdown, basically. The projects keep on evolving. We're a trusted partner. And I really think that we wouldn't have that type of relationship if we didn't collaborate. And if they weren't open to being collaborated with is probably the key part. So yeah, to your point, absolutely. It is a bit of a fork in the road for clients who are looking for our services, but want to work in a particular way. And the step for us was understanding how do we create that value. And value to us isn't the same to value to everybody else. We just want to create value to our people, if that kind of makes sense. So it's understanding that. And I think that was, for us, that was a step change for us. It's, okay, so what is it that we do that really creates value for our clients right now? Okay, that's what we need to take out to market to other clients that look a little bit like the clients that we've got.
Yeah, absolutely. So you talked a little bit about kind of marketing and business development at the start of Disruptive Thinking's journey, largely coming through kind of referrals and your network. I'm keen to dig a little bit into what that looked like and how that has evolved as you've adopted more of an agency-like model moving away from consulting. Obviously, the nature of the business changes, billable hours, constantly having to feed the machine. So what does marketing and business development look like now compared to how it looked like when you first started the organization?
Sure. So again, it comes back to that whole kind of working for yourself and working on your own, like solo sort of thing. BD was tricky because we were either delivering or we were not delivering. So we were either earning or we were not earning. And it was very hard to do the kind of BD and the marketing work whilst we were in the thick of a project, as an example. So it was, first of all, it was really bitty. It was very lumpy, the revenue that we would generate. So we would be living on a project, everything's gravy, it's really good fun. And then the project would finish and we'd be like, oh no, we need to go and find some more work now, like really quickly. So it was a bit, and as you mentioned, it was very much through our network. So through people that we knew, people that I worked before, I mentioned the old clients that we worked with in the previous kind of work. So LinkedIn was like, it still is the kind of tool to use. And there was a lot of checking in, how are things, love to come and see you, and doing that kind of like constant kind of touch point, really, in terms of trying to generate that. And it was all very manual, is that what I say? So it was spend days just going through your connections and trying to set up kind of meetings from there. Where we are now is that we've got a more robust kind of structure. And I think this is, again, the other bit that kind of comes through in the 6 or 7 years that we've been running Disruptive is the importance of having these processes, these systems in place so that you can keep doing these things, you can test, you can measure, and you can change the variables and have control on what the variables are that you change. So what I mean when I say that is that when you know you've got your kind of baseline sales or marketing process pulled together, you can say, oh, let's try doing some messaging across socials, or let's try doing some outbound emails, whatever it might be. And you change that kind of variable and you know what it is that's attributing towards the uplift or the downtick in performance. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely some work that we did around systemizing that process. What that process looks like now is we're still doing a lot of networking and we still get a lot of work through referrals as well. But we're doing much more kind of outbound activity. So we're using tools like Outbase, we're using tools like HubSpot to give us that scale, to give us that scale of outreach. And what's made that infinitely more effective has been understanding, like what we said before, understanding what the value is that we offer to the world and who within that world it is that we want to offer the value to. So that gives you an idea of what your proposition is, what distinguishes you from the rest of the market, and then who it is that you create the most value for. So you've got your target market from that as well.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people listening to this episode would probably be nodding their head saying, look, this all makes sense to me, but I'm in a similar position where I'm in this kind of feast and famine type environment where I'm just heads down delivering the work. It all feels great. And then I come out on the other end and I've got nothing left to put onto the table. And I need to think about how do I build these systems so that I get that so I have that kind of constant inflow of new opportunities coming from all these different channels. But there are so many channels for me to be choosing from. And there are so many ways that I could be expressing myself and the value that we provide as an organization. And there are so many people who that message may resonate with. Where do I start? Because I've got a company of 3 people, 5 people, and we're slammed. We can't do everything. What would you say to those listeners?
It's really hard. And I wish I had the bulletproof answer to that. And the fact of the matter is that one of the most exciting things of running your own business is you have these kind of like white knuckle moments where everything, you're getting swept away with everything that's taking you on these sorts of journeys. And I think that, you know, you've got to be really sensible to like not let it take you away and you lose some of the passion for doing it. Firstly, I think it's, as I say, I've gone through it myself with this company. I think most companies do go through it, and I don't think there's any kind of, as I say, bulletproof solution to it. But I think if I was going to go back in time a few years ago and think, what am I doing now, if I'd done a few years ago, would have made a bit of a difference. First of all, is disciplined with your BD time. So even if you are flat out, if you're time tracking, if you've got, we use Asana for our kind of resource management and capacity management, allocate, ring fence some BD time and marketing time and some strategy time as well for you to think. That one of the biggest challenges we all face is from an agent perspective is where we're too busy working in the business instead of working on the business. So ring fencing this time and being really protective over it, even if it's like an hour a month or an hour every fortnight, just for you to go out for a walk, put your headphones in and have a think, right, what do the next 6, 12, 18 months look like? One of the best bits of advice that I had was to plan for 3 years ahead, like a whole kind of 3-year plan thing. It's a 12-quarter plan, so it goes in no time, but it's far enough out that you can see where you want to head to, but it's also close enough in that you can make a difference to what it looks like over the next few months. So ring fencing that time is absolutely massive, because business development, all those those ideas and the strategies and the things in the internal campaigns that you want to run to build up your pipeline, that's when those moments will come out. And then you've got that plan that you can execute against. So discipline is definitely it. You've got to carve that time out so you can, I don't think you'll ever get rid of the really like busy times and the slightly quieter times, but you could make that bandwidth a little bit narrower in terms of being able to plan out that work a little bit better, being able to see when you've got a bit of a gap, let's go and find some short-term projects we can fill that gap in. But the key thing is around discipline, Jason. And I think that's the thing. I still have to do it to myself now, because you'd be like, I've got to do this, or this deadline is hitting around me. And it's way easier to do, to say than it is to do, especially when I've got a small team. It's hard enough with 5. So with 3, it's really tricky, but it comes from you. You've got to put that time aside and you just keep doing it. And it's, yeah, that's the whole leveraging thing. So if you can do a half an hour a day of BD work, of connection building, whatever it might be, that's a leveraging time, because that'll come back with one of those calls, come back with a reasonable size project. That's it. You've done it. You've tripled your whatever multiple of your time, that initial work.
The discipline thing is really interesting and something that really resonates with me, because when talking from personal experience, I'm a year into building this agency. The times where I've started feeling anxious about BD and I've said, okay, well, I just need to get this done. Like, I need to do something to start filling the pipeline, and I give it that concentrated time and attention. It doesn't happen straight away, but you can then start seeing the effects a month later, 2 months later, where, okay, those seeds I planted back then are now starting to bear fruit. And so you need to get a jump on it earlier. But I think the discipline, it goes beyond just simply, hey, I need to do the activity. You've talked a lot about kind of data and analysis and tracking what works and what doesn't work. And the discipline carries through to that as well, because it's all well and good saying, okay, I'm going to give the time just to send a bunch of emails or tap into my network or invest in a bunch of content and try and build that inbound machine. But if you're not actually looking at the other end of, okay, what did yield results and have that system in place to do that effectively and at scale, you're just going to end up just throwing spaghetti at the wall and hoping something sticks, right?
100%. And that's the tech and the tools that we have now, means that old saying of, I know that 50% of my marketing budget is working, I just don't know which 50% it is. That doesn't really apply now, because you should be able to put into place all the tracking, all the systems, and again, systems and processes into place, so that you can see what interventions you have made that have yielded the strongest results, and right the way down to the nuances of messaging, for example, and the tone that you use. Do you use like a cheery tone or a very analytical tone or whatever? What gives you the traction with the people that you're trying to get traction with? And you should be able to measure that. You should be able to be, you know, aware of all these variables that you're using in your marketing and your BD, and then really capitalize on stuff that's working and do less of the stuff that's not working so well.
Yeah. Not to put you on the spot, but if I had to say, what are like two or three really practical, tactical things that people could do or put in place today to just begin to get a better understanding on what's working across my business development and prospecting efforts and what's not? Things that maybe when you're helping clients implement a new HubSpot instance within their organization, you're saying, this is going to give you that visibility if we do this now. What are some things that come to mind?
I think the most profound change that I made personally, and to be fair, I'm dodging the question a little bit here, Jason. And this is more when I was working for the publisher, but it was really understanding the customer journey. Like from the point where they don't know who you are to the point where they are shouting from the rooftops about what a wonderful partner you are. Really understanding what does that journey look like? Where are the key milestones along that journey? And what are the key conversion points along that journey as well? And then how do you optimize those conversions so they're more likely to move from one stage to the next? So that was probably the number one thing. The number two thing is also understanding what's their status quo. When I say that, it's one of the clients that we used to work with is Xero. Most people know what Xero is, an accounting software. I remember chatting with their marketing manager, Zubair, and he said to me that their biggest competitor is not Intuit or Sage or anything like that. The spreadsheets are the biggest competitor. And people who are using spreadsheets were not ready to hear the message about how Xero could do this, that, and the other for you. They were safe in the space of using spreadsheets. So from a marketing perspective, what we needed to do was get people to let go of the status quo. They weren't ready to even look at what you can do until they're ready to let go of what they did before. And it's understanding how you can move people from that, holding on tightly to what they feel safe, and nobody's going to get sacked for putting an advert in the papers these days, or whatever it was at the time. Like getting them to let go of the status quo, to have a look at what their options are, for them to value the key things that you can do that not many other people can do, and then move them on that journey. Because once you've got them on that journey, then they're ready. They're ready to be developed, to be nurtured and things like this. But the first step in that is, first of all, understanding what their status quo is and then plotting the route that you need to take them on to get them to the point where they're a customer and then where they become advocates. Mm-hmm. And once you understand that, and when you understand what the milestones are, you can start building your strategy, your campaigns, your marketing to take them around that. I guess in your line of work, it may well be that people have never done podcasts before, never considered it as medium, all the way through to they understand what kind of impact it has. They understand the value of high production, of using tools like Riverside or whatever it might be. Then they're out in the market and they find you and they go, blimey, this is everything that we need. And you imagine that kind of inbound lead, you're like, this is dreamy, come on in. So it's understanding and mapping what that kind of journey looks like, and then understanding what are the levers that you can pull, what kind of content you can publish, what kind of events you might organize or webinars you might host or whatever it might be, and to take them along that journey. So that, for me, understanding the status quo, understanding your processes, and then understand how you can optimize each step are probably the three things that I would say to do. But that it all centers around understanding your client and knowing what are the pain points that they suffer from at the moment and how your solution helps to address some of those things. And it goes all the way back to what we were talking about before and around that differentiation piece and understanding that what differentiates you really means something to some people. And it's understanding who those some people are and why it means something to them.
Yeah. And setting up those markers so you can start understanding what's landing and what's not landing and when and where and with who and what have you. And your status quo point is a great one. I think it's April Dunford, the positioning expert who I saw speak once, say that analysis suggests that 40% of all B2B deals are lost to the status quo. We're just going to continue doing what we're doing right now. And getting closer to your customers is obviously really important. I think sometimes there is, depending on the organization, a reluctance to get close to customers in this way, to like conduct customer research that's going to fuel like business development and marketing efforts. I think in some organizations, if you're thinking kind of high volume, low price point SaaS, where there's not that kind of face-to-face touch point necessarily. Customers have a relationship with the brand. They're buying the platform using their credit card on the website. It's maybe slightly easier to pick up some of those kind of indicators on what's working and what's not working and build systems to do that. I remember working in a previous company, large enterprise sales, maybe only 100 clients, but those clients are worth many millions of dollars each. And the relationship is ring-fenced by an account manager and maybe an executive. And so if you're going to them as a marketer and you're saying, hey, I need 30 minutes with CTO X because I want to understand their thought process around what led them to coming to the point where they wanted to buy something from us. Okay, just give us the questions. We'll ask on our next meeting with them if something's not on fire on the project, but something's usually on fire, so it never gets asked. And so finding the way to get those insights in that kind of environment is a whole other kind of kettle of fish.
It really is. It really is. And you've got to work with what you have. And I guess from a founder's position for other agencies like ours, or even a little bit bigger, it comes back to that people strategy. And it comes back to, if you've got like a high touch point proposition or service where you have account directors or whatever that really have that kind of hands-on, or even embedded people in organizations, and it really comes down to people and the strength of your people to be able to do that, to be able to be curious, inquisitive, to be creative and to a degree challenging as well, asking those questions and just thinking, is there a better way of doing this? Is there some, can we make a change here that will be beneficial? Rather than, as you say, sticking with the status quo. It's that thing. People aren't going to get sacked for doing what's always been done. So we need to be able to be a little bit brave and to give our clients confidence to be a bit brave and to try these new things.
Ewan, this has been a really fascinating discussion. I've certainly taken a lot away from it that I'm going to go away and implement into my own business. And so thank you very much for that. Where can people learn more about you and about disruptive thinking?
Oh, just check us out online. We're at hellodisruptive.com.
We'll drop a link to the website and to your LinkedIn profile in the show notes of this episode. But otherwise, thank you very much for coming on to B2B Better. So today, once again, I'm joined by my friend Kit Smith. Kit, how are you doing?
Yeah, good, thanks.
So Ewan spoke at length there about this idea of carving out dedicated business development time, which is really good advice. But I think a lot of founders and listeners to this podcast will then naturally ask, okay, what next? I've got this time. What do I do to start filling it? So with that being said, what advice do you and SoPro have for kicking off an MVP prospecting strategy and filling this time?
Yeah, we've obviously worked with a lot of companies that kind of have gone through this journey or are somewhere on that journey and are working out their options. And I think there's a lot of different ways to tackle it, right? And I think quite a common one is, it sounds like what Ewan did with Disruptive, is you start with using your network, and it's really, that works really well, right? Because those tend to be pretty good quality conversations that you have, but it'll only get you so far. You can't like really scale that all that far. And so then you can move into other areas, and that might be like email and LinkedIn and stuff. If you're talking about cold outreach, like you can obviously dedicate time for content and inbound. But again, it is time consuming. I think if you're doing it manually, if you're talking about outbound and you're looking on LinkedIn for the right people, it just takes a lot of time to do that. And then a common part of the journey is, we'll bring in some tech, we can like automate, we can scale and whatever. But as you do that and you systemize this approach, like that kind of efficiency creates its own problem, because then you need even more time to deal with that level of really. So obviously that's where us as an agency tend to come in, that people go, we've done this and we didn't realize that actually it's a full-time job, like running that whole prospecting thing. Yeah, not only is a kind of agency, it's filled with people that are dedicated to it, that have kind of got that experience and expertise, but like then you're just outsourcing that time that you've ring-fenced, you like move that to someone else, and then you focus on other projects that kind of help move the needle. But yeah, it's different. I think everyone has to, it might be a combination, it might be that journey between the three that I said. I think it'll be different for everyone. I totally agree that carving out that time is the important thing, and testing what works for you. And I think part of that, I think like Ewan alluded to this, but part of doing it yourself is it helps solidify some of those kind of like aspects of your business that, yeah, okay, what really is our proposition? Obviously you're going to know that, but when you're forced to confront it in terms of how other people perceive that and how it works for prospecting and your testing and your learning, like that sort of stuff, and what distinguishes you, who exactly are you going after? When you have to build an audience of people, you really have to nail, dive into that. So you just, by doing some of that stuff initially yourself, you can learn some quite valuable lessons.
Another topic that Ewan started to unpack was this idea of deeply understanding the customer journey, which at face value sounds like really good advice, and I'm sure a lot of people listening to this would totally agree with. But how can an early stage business go about beginning to get this level of insight and action it against their business development strategy? How do we start to understand what that customer journey looks like for our specific customers? Because it's going to be different on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such a common problem, I think, isn't it? That we all know. So understanding your audience, everyone would agree, I think, that's like a vital part of it. And things like the qualitative stuff, interviews, surveys, questionnaires are all amazing. I think some of those are easier than others. So you can post pitch kind of thing. If that's part of your process that you speak to everyone, whether you've won or lost that piece of business, like that kind of can give you some vital stuff. On the pitch itself, obviously, if you're going through a good discovery, you start to learn a bit of that. I think even just in, if you are in that kind of manual part of prospecting where you're going to, you might be going to networking events and stuff, just speaking to your audience, there's all sorts of stuff that you can start to get that. Obviously, a more, you can do approaches that might cost more money and that are more like solidified and more, okay, this is a panel and whatever, but you don't have to get that far. But it's difficult to get. It's so important, but really understand. And to also note that it's actually an ongoing thing. So you might manage to secure some funding to look into that. And then like a year later or whatever it is, 6 months later, you've got to keep an eye on how that's changing because obviously things do. But yeah, it's a difficult one. I think it's interesting you talked about that losing deals to the status quo. I think that's something that a lot of people will probably identify with. And I think made me think of, I can't remember where, but I heard this idea of people aren't necessarily motivated by the fear of missing out, like missing out on the opportunity that you represent. They're often more motivated by the fear of messing up and being the person that's responsible for signing that bad contract and spending the money that gets no return. Yeah, there's just no risk with spending, or there's much less risk with spending no money, right? So yeah, this kind of research is about finding out how you lower that risk for them and what motivates them. What's the potential benefit behind the obvious thing? And then, yeah, how do you pull all of those levers? How do you take them on that journey? But then you can also, with a bit of that insight, qualitative insight, you can then use data to back up those decisions, I think, and to find out where to optimize the journey.
And you've queued me up nicely for my final question, which is around data. And we all know that we should be leveraging data to drive our decision-making. And obviously, this is something that Ewan spoke to about how he's applied it into his own business. But how do we begin to identify what is the right kind of data to follow and what is just noise and should be put aside?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think first, if you're really a really small business, you need those kind of systems that are going to collect the data about your kind of customers and their journey. So obviously, like a CRM, which you can get for free, web analytics, sadly, that's probably Google Analytics 4 these days for people, which is a lot harder to use, but still can give you some insights. Yeah, there might be outreach software or Sales Navigator. You might have internal data, the usage of your platform, if you're at SaaS or whatever it is. All that journey together, all that data together can help you map out that journey. And I think something that can be difficult is that those journeys can be very complex and varied, but you can still take a view of it. And I think like traditional kind of ideas like sales pipeline or marketing funnel help with this kind of thing. Because you can look at, okay, where's the leak? Where do people drop out more at what stage? And there are so many. Like if you are, let's say you're email prospecting, there's a sequence of emails. What happens if you change the subject line on the first email or the content of the second or if you're then driving people to the website, however you're doing that, like which pages are the ones that people tend to visit when they convert? And then how can you get more people to those pages? There's so many different parts of the journey that you can look at. And obviously that's kind of part of the problem, but it's part of the beauty of it. I think, yeah, in terms of what to pay attention to and what to cast aside, there's kind of two main sort of aspects to look at. One, you obviously don't want to base decisions on small amounts of data. You want big enough numbers to be confident in that insight. But obviously that can be difficult when you're starting out, that you don't have a huge audience. So I think the big thing is to have, you start with your own hypothesis. And hopefully because if you have done some of that kind of qualitative work speaking to your audience, then you understand your brand, you feel you understand your audience and their journey, and then you start having kind of data that backs up some of that or challenges it, then you can start to understand where is best, where to begin on that kind of optimization of that journey.
Thanks very much for helping me unpack that episode with Ewan. As a reminder to our listeners of B2B Better, SoPro have just published a fantastic report, The State of Prospecting 2024, authored by our very own Kit Smith here. Highly recommend that you check it out. I'm going to be dropping the link to it in the show notes of this episode. But otherwise, Kit Smith, thank you so much for coming once again onto B2B Better.
Cheers, Jason.
And that's it for this episode of B2B Better. Thank you so much for giving me your time this week. If you are a repeat listener, thanks for coming back. If you did take any value out of this interview, please make sure you subscribe, rate, and review in your podcast platform of choice. It really makes a huge difference for an emerging creator like myself. Ugh, that sounded so bad, emerging creator. But I'm going to stick with it because we're here. If you want to learn more about the services at B2B Better, you can visit my website, www.b2b-better.com. A huge thanks to my guest this week. See you all next week.